Hei, du hører nå på en podcast fra Litteraturhuset I Trondheim.
Welcome everybody. It's really good to see so many of you here, and welcome Caroline. I'm so thrilled that I can welcome you here in Trondheim, and I'm really happy to see so many here today. What we are going to do is that we are going to talk about your book, and I have some questions, and we have a conversation on your book, and then after about 45 minutes, max 1 hour, we're going to open for questions from the audience, and if you're going to hit 2 hours, I hope somebody is going to call us out and say you've used your time. Before we get to your book, I would like to get the audience some impression of who you are and have some questions on this. And you're sometimes presented, and this is also how I perceive you, so I'm a bit starstruck today, as one of the most well-known and important international feminist activists of our time. And I wonder, what is it that made you so engaged? Can you tell us a little bit about you?
So that's a really long story, so we may well be hitting the 2 hour mark. I think it started in my mid-20s. And I think the reason that I got so engaged is this kind of like becoming a born-again Christian, right? I sort of discovered it in my mid-20s, and I was like, oh my God, what is going on here? Sorry, I'm making a mess with my microphone. The audio, nice audio man told me not to sit on the cable and not to make a mess, and I'm already making a mess. So I'm gonna tie my hair back, so excuse me 1 second while I try and do this. So before that point, I actually had not been a feminist, so it really was not inevitable that I became a feminist activist. I would definitely have described myself as an anti-feminist. I found feminism embarrassing, and I thought that it made women look weak, and I didn't want to be associated with that. I didn't want to be associated with the idea that I needed extra help because I was a lady. I thought, you know, I'm as good as any man, and anyway, we're all equal now, so if women aren't doing as well as men, that's probably because they're just not as good as men, except for me. Because I definitely am. So just make sure you treat me like you would treat any other guy. So that's kind of, I was insufferable. And this sort of continued through till I got to university as a mature student. And I had to read this book, which changed my life. Which was called Feminism and Linguistic Theory. I had to read it for my university degree. I wasn't like picking it up in the bookstore. And in this book, the author, Deborah Cameron, talks about the generic masculine. So obviously that's not very pervasive in British English, but it means, so it's basically things like he to mean he or she, man to mean humankind. And, you know, when I was reading this at first, I was obviously just rolling my eyes, thinking, you know, classic feminists, they've got nothing better to do than complain about a gender-neutral term. Every one knows it means he or she. How petty are they? And again, I'd heard this argument before. So mm-hmm. I had all my arguments well rehearsed of like, you know, I'm not one of those annoying women who cares that you use he to mean he or she. I'm much more laid back than that. But then she went on to talk about studies that show that when people hear or read these words, they picture a man. And that was the moment my life changed, because I suddenly realized, oh my God, that's what I'm doing. I'm picturing a man. And more than being shocked that I was picturing a man, I was shocked that I'd never noticed it. You know, how could I not have seen what was going on inside my own head? And I started noticing, actually, it's not just when I hear these obviously male words, it's much more gender-neutral words like doctor, lawyer, politician, writer, journalist. I was just picturing men all the time. And so that was just a real wake-up moment for me, that I didn't really know what was going on in my own head. So that, I think, because that was my introduction, you know, I think people reach feminism through lots of different paths. But because my path was this, of recognizing wow, I've been thinking I'm talking gender neutrally, and actually I've been talking about men the whole time, and I didn't notice, especially as a woman. Mm. So that I started noticing all these other areas where we think we're speaking gender neutrally, and actually it transpires we're usually talking about men. So after my first degree, I went and I studied feminist economics and behavioral economics, and that was where I discovered this huge data gap in the economy, in the economic data that we collect, where we really design our economy around this mythical being called Homo economicus, who is, you know, literally a man, and we don't account for all the unpaid labor that women do, taking care of children, taking care of older people, taking care of sick people, unpaid, and the huge contribution that has to the economy. And of course, that's an ideological decision. That's not because that doesn't have any impact on the economy, but because we don't count it, it means that when we're allocating resources without accounting for that work, and that really lets women down. But when we talk about the economy, we're not talking about the men's economy. We're talking about the gender-neutral economy. Mm. It just isn't actually gender-neutral. And the next thing that I came across was I did a little bit of volunteering with this female asylum seekers charity, which is where I came across the UN Convention on Refugees, which is another gender-neutral bit of international law and a very well-meaning one. And yet, it could be called the UN Convention on Male Refugees because of the way that it is designed around the typical male experience of political persecution. So things like you have to leave the country that you're fleeing from before you can claim asylum. It's much harder for a woman to do. They're less likely to be able to travel legally, to be able to get a visa. Often they'll be coming from countries where they can't travel without a male guardian. And then things like, even when you get to the country that you're going to claim asylum in, you can't just say, I'm being persecuted. You have to show how the persecution that you experience fits into a number of very specific scenarios, like political persecution, religious persecution, all of which are reasons that women can be persecuted. But the number one reason that female asylum seekers give for why they're being persecuted is because they're women. And that is not a reason that you can use. You can't say it's because of my sex or because of my gender. So this was sort of gradually building up, you know, collecting all these examples in my head and starting to feel like I was going to explode, that everyone was talking gender neutrally and I knew that they weren't. And then when I was writing my first book, I came across this research about medicine and discovering that even in medicine, science, the study of actual human bodies, we are treating the male body as if it's a gender-neutral body, and we're collecting data on the male body and using that data to say, this is what heart disease looks like, this is what cancer looks like, these are the thresholds we're going to test, here are the treatments, we've tested them on men, here you go, women, have a drug that we haven't tested on your body in any way. And unsurprisingly, it means that we diagnose women less and we treat them less effectively. And that was just so incredibly shocking to me. You know, it's one thing to say, well, women are underrepresented in parliaments or women are underrepresented in the media. You know, obviously, it shouldn't be like that, but you can sort of you can rationalize it by saying, well, historically, you know, women didn't have rights and they only got rights in the past 100 years and blah, blah, blah. You can't make that argument for why we don't study female bodies in the context of medicine. And I say female because, of course, it's not just human bodies. It's also animals and even cells that we are studying, the male. Hmm. And how could you not be engaged when you've got all that going on and you see everyone walking around as if everything's totally fine and normal and speaking gender neutrally and you just want to grab people and shake them and say it's not gender neutral?
Yeah.
So that's basically me.
I see, yeah. I made some notes here for my syllabus for my students. you didn't only get engaged, but you also had many successes. Because one thing is that we picture maybe a man when we are thinking about scientists. Mm-hmm. But one thing is also that you showed that we're actually picturing men when there are many women. And an example is that you're known for is that you made the Bank of England print more women on their banknotes.
Yeah.
Because before, it was only the Queen among many men.
Yeah.
And another of your successes is that you made Twitter install a report abuse button. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether there are some people here in the room who tried to get in contact with companies like Facebook or TikTok, and the only thing you meet is this general customer information form. Mm-hmm. But you actually made Twitter do something different. How did you make this?
Well, it actually started with the banknotes campaign. So the banknotes campaign was the Bank of England announced that they were going to remove the only female historical figure from the back of English and Welsh banknotes and replace her with a man. And so it was going to be all men. And in my naivety, I was a sort of fairly newly fledged born-again feminist. And I sort of thought, I guess because I had this experience of, oh, it just hadn't been pointed out to me. And now that it's been pointed out to me, I now get all of this. I thought maybe the Bank of England just hadn't noticed that all the banknotes were going to be men. And I would just point it out to them and they'd go, thank you so much for alerting us to this terrible oversight. Obviously, we'll get that changed right away. That didn't happen. But they did end up changing it because, you know, I ran this whole campaign and we that was sort of quite high profile in the UK in the media. But the day that they announced that they were going to put a female historical figure, they chose Jane Austen to go on the back of the £10 notes, I got my first rape threat. And it just built from there. I got more and more rape threats, death threats, mutilation threats, people digging up my address, trying to hunt me down. It was absolutely terrifying. And this also became huge news in the UK. And one of the issues that I talked about, because I was obviously talking about the fact that this was happening, was how difficult it was to report to Twitter that people were trying to kill me and that people were posting my address on Twitter. And that was because at the time, there wasn't a report abuse button. You had to go to this totally separate website and fill out this whole form where you had to copy and paste in the link of the tweet, then you had to copy and paste in the text of the tweet, so I was having to write out, I am going to rape you, and then explain why the tweet was offensive. Like, I wasn't offended, I was terrified. And, you know, so each form, you know, takes like a few minutes, but when you're getting rape threats coming in every minute, you don't have time to do all this. So we made a lot of noise. You know, it wasn't just me. Obviously, I was at the center of it because I was the one it was happening to. But there were loads of people on Twitter who were also making a huge amount of fuss. Mm-hmm. And it was really the huge public pressure and the media storm that came along with it that ended up with them having to make this change.
Mm. So managed to link people and luckily make this change. I hope it's better now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not getting threatened with rape every minute on Twitter, so that's a good development.
That's a good development, right. We're talking about your book today, and it's called Invisible Women. Mm-hmm. There are many women visible here in this room, in the audience today. Uh-huh. We're going to have a cue, the ladies. And that's ever since I read your book, I'm raging every time I'm standing in this queue in front of a public toilet, because I think it really shouldn't be like this.
No, it shouldn't.
You have a good suggestion on how it actually should be.
Well, I mean, more female toilets. It's not complicated. So basically the issue that we have in traditional toilet design is the idea of equality being that you give the same to everyone and that's equality. It would be equality if everyone had the same needs. But when you have different needs, you need to serve people differently. So what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, generally, if you give equal floor space to the male and female toilets, because urinals take up less space than a cubicle, it means you actually have more facilities in this particular square meter space than you do in the female toilet. So for a start, men actually get more than women generally. But the other issue then you start to look into is there's actually more demand for the female toilet. Why is that? Well, for a start, women are more likely to be accompanied by young children or by older people. And so that means there are more people using the female toilet. Then women tend to, for all sorts of reasons, be using the toilet more frequently. So for example, if you're pregnant, you're going to be going to the toilet more frequently. also the sort of 25% or so who will be menstruating at any one time will be using the toilet more frequently and also will take longer in the toilet. And that's the other issue, is that not only are more people using the toilet, that they also will, women tend to take longer. Basically for simple things like a man can, I'm imagining this because I'm not a man and I've never used a urinal, but I imagine you just walk up to it, you unzip, off you go, and then you leave and hopefully you wash your hands. Women have, it takes longer, not much longer, but a bit longer. So you walk in, you have to find a cubicle that's free, you know, pushing against the doors. You go in, take your coat off, you turn around, take off your trousers. You probably have to clean the loo seat because it's disgusting. And then you finally sit down and then you have to reverse the procedure. Now, obviously for each individual person, that's not that long. But when you add that up with a lot of people, you see how the queue starts to get longer. So you've got more demand for the female toilet. Women, for all sorts of reasons, will be taking longer and they actually have fewer facilities. Mm. So it's really very simple. Mm. And the end result of that is that women need more facilities than men instead of the other way around. So it's like, it's not like, it's just very, very simple mathematics that just give women more toilets.
In Norway, they have this tradition for very big demonstrations on Women's Day with all the different kind of slogans. So it would be a very concrete slogan, transform all the men toilets into gender neutral and keep the ladies.
I mean, yeah, that'd be great. I'm not sure it'll happen, but the very simple answer is, yeah, just more toilets all around.
Mm-hmm. And today you came to us from Oslo, taking a plane and then a cab from the airport, I think. And in your book, you write that you sometimes get a bit nauseous when being in the car. And this is also a bit more female issue, women and car sickness. But we are not sure, we don't know, because what do we know about?
Yeah, well, as with a lot of things pertaining to the female body, we don't really know much about it. I interviewed this guy who researches motion sickness. And it was really interesting what he said, because he said that it's something that we've known for forever, basically. He said it's been in the literature forever that women get more motion sickness than men, but no one's actually looked into why, because just, like, who cares? But he decided to look into it because he said he was sort of looking around at various bits of research. And his theory about motion sickness is different to the sort of mainstream theory. So the mainstream theory is about a disconnect between what you're seeing and what your inner ear is experiencing. But he thinks it's actually about postural sway. So as when you're standing or you're sitting, your body is making loads of tiny micro adjustments all the time to keep yourself upright. And when you're in a moving vehicle, obviously you're having to make more of those adjustments. Because the center of gravity is different in women than in men because of the different pelvis and different muscle mass distribution on average, he thinks that's what the sex difference is. The other interesting thing that he said was that it also changes with the menstrual cycle. Hmm. So your propensity to get motion sickness changes. We still don't really know. And he said the only way to ensure that you weren't going to be sick, it would be to have, like, the headrest and everything holding you, like, really still. And that made me really interested when he said that, because I thought, okay, so I'm going to look into cars now. I wonder how cars are designed. I wonder if they've looked into headrests. And because I always thought that I find the headrest really uncomfortable. It's always in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find any research on that. No one has done any research on headrests. But I did come across the fact that cars as a whole are really not designed for women at all. And the headrests do come into it in a way. Mm-hmm. It turns out that the most commonly used car crash test dummy, and it was the only car crash test dummy that was used for a really long time, is based around the body of the average American man, as if the average American man is the average human being. This means that cars, in all sorts of ways, don't work as well for women as for men in terms of safety. So, for example, women tend to sit further forward than men because women on average are shorter. So we have to sit further forward to like reach the steering wheel and the pedals, quite an important part of driving. But that puts us out of the safest position for driving because we're closer and it hasn't been designed for a body that's sitting that far forward. Other issues include things like the seatbelt, this amazing safety tool, but it's been designed to catch on your hip bones. But of course, women's pelvises are not just small male pelvises. They are differently shaped. And so what happens is that instead of, what can happen is that instead of the seatbelt catching on your hip bones, it can ride up and catch instead on your internal organs and of course cause catastrophic bleeding. Another one that I thought that was really interesting to come into the headrests, I keep catching my thing on the chair, is when you talk about car safety design, people often sort of say, well, how can we possibly design for all sorts of different types of people? I mean, my answer to that is obviously adaptability. But there is a big problem with not at least trying to design for lots of different types of people. And the headrests is a really interesting example because there are two types of whiplash prevention systems that are in most modern cars. There's one called the active head restraint system. And that is basically that the seat kind of pushes you forward, including with the headrest. And that's meant to mitigate the damage of the rear impact because it's meant to hold you in place, basically, exactly like this guy was saying about motion sickness. And then the other one is meant to kind of do a sort of backwards forwards motion like a cradle. So it cradles you in. And what's really, really interesting about this is a Swedish biomechanics researcher looked into both these systems to see how they performed for men versus women. And she had to rely on crash data, actual crashes. So she had to wait quite a long time of people being in these crashes to get the data because they hadn't bothered to do the testing before they released it into the cars. And it turns out that the active head restraints really improved whiplash injury for men, but made it much worse for women. And bear in mind that women are much more likely to suffer all kinds of injuries, but including whiplash, which is the most common injury in a car crash. Whereas the other system improved it for both men and women. So that just shows that there are design changes that you can make that will make things, you know, worse for women, or you can implement design changes that will make things better for everyone. Mm. But anyway, at the moment, because most car safety is designed around this one mid-sized male dummy, the result is that women are much less safe in the event of a car crash. So women are 17% more likely to die and 47% more likely to be seriously injured than a man in the same car crash. Now, there is what is called a female car crash test dummy that is used in some of the tests. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the book, this dummy was used in one out of the five regulatory tests in the EU. And so not, you know, because women only make up 1/5 of the EU population, and only in the passenger seat. So because women don't drive in the EU. I mean, I'm sure it's different in Norway, but in the EU, women don't drive. And that's the same in the US, by the way. Women don't drive in the US either, which is why they're not tested in the driver's seat. But in any case, this female car crash test dummy is actually just a very scaled down male dummy. And as we've kind of been exploring, women are not just tiny men. And so this tiny dummy doesn't really account for example, you know, the pelvic differences that I was talking about. That means the seatbelt is actually can be dangerous in the event of a crash for women. I'm not telling you don't wear your seatbelt, by the way. I'm just saying we need to develop a better seatbelt. And also, like, you know, if anyone's pregnant, there is no seatbelt that's been designed for pregnancy. And the number one cause of fetal death from impact is car crashes. And of course, that's been going on for decades. Sorry, you asked me about motion sickness. Now we've gone on this whole rant. Cars was, you know, I started off just wanting to find out about headrests. And then I came across this whole thing of, like, actually the whole car is a total car crash.
We're laughing a bit because it's so ridiculous that this is happening, but it's also outrageous because of this really severe consequences.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the crash test dummies because one of your most important points in the book is to show that we're not actually collecting the data to know what really would fit to a female body. And you call this the gender data gap. Mm-hmm. And you show that this gender data gap is really persisting in all sectors and aspects of the society, economy, from the daily life over traffic, over the public life, medicine, everywhere. Mm-hmm. I'm sure even if you knew much of this, you also met many surprises. Do you have examples of what was most surprising for you?
The car crashes was pretty surprising. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the best examples in a way, because it's sort of the clearest example of my thesis, which is that we don't collect data because we think men are gender neutral. And this use of a male dummy to represent the average human, you couldn't get a better example than that. Mm. Of how did we spend so many years saying, yes, we test this in humans, and actually it was based on an average male body. Another example, not necessarily that surprising, but which I find quite illustrative, is the use of unisex stab vests. So stab vests will be given to emergency workers. And the unisex stab vest is designed for the unisex body. And as we know, the unisex body is the body that doesn't have breasts. The one that has breasts isn't unisex. But if you were to give men a unisex stab vest that was designed for a body with breasts, they would be like, what is this? Is this a joke? But somehow we don't think it's weird that we do that to the other half of the global population. I suppose one of the things that I found most surprising really was when, because I do think that a lot of this is just people not thinking, people not, because we're so used to thinking of men as gender neutral, we often really don't notice when we're doing it. The thing that I find surprising is when people are aware that this is what they're doing and still try to justify it. When I speak to researchers about, why have you only decided to do this study in men, they will say, the menstrual cycle will interfere with the results.
Right.
And the menstrual cycle, of course, is just like a really uncommon thing. Like, basically, no one has one. So why should we include it in our tests? I mean, the concerning thing, of course, is that they are right. It will interfere with the results. That interaction can be very severe. So women, for example, are more likely to experience drug-induced heart rhythm abnormalities, which, of course, can be fatal. And that risk is highest during the first half of the menstrual cycle. So that's the kind of thing you might like to know before you give someone this drug that might cause a heart attack in them. But the other thing that's sort of really frustrating about this is that it doesn't even explain a lot of it. Because, for example, it's not, as I said, it's not just female humans, it's also female animals, who admittedly often have a menstrual cycle, but it's also female cells, and cells don't have a menstrual cycle. So there's really no reason to be testing solely in male cells, and this actually really does matter, because research starts in cells. The more that researchers do start to look into the differences between male and female cells, the more that they find that these differences really matter. So to give you an example from the book, there was a study that was done in 2016 where they exposed male and female cells to estrogen and then exposed them to a virus. The female cells were able to use the estrogen to fight off the virus. The male cells, the estrogen didn't do anything. And so they weren't able to fight off the virus. And you read a study like that and you think, how many treatments have we missed out on for women because we only tested them in male cells at that stage and we're like, oh, well, this doesn't have any impact. Let's move on to the next thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's the conclusion we might well have drawn from estrogen. And when you look at adverse drug reactions, one of the most common adverse drug reactions in women is that the drug simply doesn't work. But there are also examples of the drug being actually really dangerous for women. So there's one study that found that 8 out of the 10 drugs that were released, taken off the market over, I think it was about a decade, were taken off the market because of unacceptable dangerous side effects in women. So 80%, that's it's not a great track record.
No. What is it about medical studies that you wouldn't pick up this before you launched the drug on the market? What is it about medical studies?
I should explain that. Well, they're not testing them in women. They're not including women in the research because we're too complicated. To measure. You have to admit, women are very complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
and they're also not sex disaggregating their data, and that really matters. So to give another example of why you should always sex disaggregate your data, it's basically, you know, it can hide really important differences. So one of the things I wrote about in the book is this, basically it's an advanced kind of pacemaker called a CRTD, which you put into someone with problems with their heart, and it extends their life, basically. And there is a threshold at which, you know, that you put it in. So the patient has to have this particular reading to get the CRTD. And they had it at this particular threshold because the studies had been male-dominated and they hadn't sex disaggregated the data. It turned out it was actually biased towards men. And when someone went and did a meta-analysis and sex disaggregated all the data of the previous studies and put them together, they found that the threshold had been set too high for women and that lots of women who could have benefited from this pacemaker were not given the pacemaker and obviously went on to die. So it's really those things. It's that we're not including women. And even when we do include women, we don't sex disaggregate. And as for, I know you weren't asking me this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I mean, one of the things that I think would make it really, that I think we should just do straight away, that would make this problem super visible and therefore more likely to stop, is that journals should stop allowing researchers to publish papers where they make gender-neutral claims, but their study has only been in male cells, male animals, male humans, right? They should have to say in the title, you know, I don't know, blood pressure in male rats says this, instead of blood pressure says this, which is what they currently do, which is infuriating. And as soon as you force people to start actually naming what they're doing and stop them being able to hide behind gender neutrality, this extent of the problem becomes so much more visible and so much harder to defend. And the pressure, I think, to address it would grow much larger. I mean, similarly with car crashes. I mean, one of the things that frustrates me about the car crashes is, as you say, this is shocking. You know, women are dying. Every year, thousands of women are dying from preventable injuries in car crashes. This is a scandal, but most people don't know about it because we don't present the data for men and women separately. You know, even with this ridiculous small male dummy, they're presenting the data all together. So you look at the car safety data and it says, oh, this car has achieved a five-star safety rating. It doesn't tell you, but we only tested it in this dummy, which is a small dummy in the passenger seat in one of the tests. As soon as you start having to explain that, then it becomes much harder to resist the impetus for change. You know, kind of like you asked me about how did you get Twitter to change their policies? They had to, because everyone was saying this is unacceptable. Car manufacturers aren't experiencing that because most people just don't know. So I did actually get in touch with Euro NCAP. So they're the European consumer body for car safety testing. And ask them, you know, will you commit to being transparent in your safety ratings? And they actually acknowledge there's not really much point right now because the dummies are not different enough. So that was nice. But there actually has been designed a female car crash test dummy. She's not an average female. And there are certain engineers who think that is actually what we need. We need an average female because what you have at the moment, the dummies that exist are the average male, a 5th percentile female, there's actually a male, and a 95th percentile male. And so the average is meant to measure, obviously, the average, and then the fifth and 95th are meant to measure the extremes. And some engineers say that the purpose of the fifth percentile and the 95th percentile is just a different thing. It's serving a different purpose, and it doesn't take away the need for an average dummy. But nevertheless, there is a dummy that is the fifth percentile, which has been designed around a female body. Like, she has a female pelvis. So that would be great.
Yeah.
But that's not being used right now.
No, we are collecting many slogans here for the next Women Day. I hope somebody is taking notes. But one thing is this study, medical studies that on diseases that both concern men and women. But what about studies on diseases that only concern women, like things that might appear under a pregnancy or mm-hmm. when giving birth? Mm-hmm. Then they, I suppose, then at least they are forced to include women. What's happening then?
Yeah. No. Well, you may think that, but. So there was this hilarious study I came across when I was researching the book, and it was for this drug that was called female Viagra. I don't know if you guys remember this. It came out about 7 years ago. Maybe not. Maybe you guys don't need female Viagra in Norway. It was huge in the UK, and it was reported all across the media. Female Viagra, woohoo! And so I decided to go and look at the study, and. The study I found was about the interaction of the drug with alcohol, because they were concerned that the drug might have a negative interaction with alcohol. And so, quite rightly, they thought we should study this. And so they found themselves 23 men and 2 women and tested female Viagra for interaction with alcohol. And, you know, you don't need to be a scientist to know that actually women metabolize alcohol slightly differently. So testing this drug for women on 23 men and 2 women is not great. Oh, and they also didn't sex disaggregate their data. So, I mean, to be fair, 2 women, it's not really going to give you enough data. But, No, we do still test it in men. But yeah, I mean, one of the other issues is that these kinds of diseases that are more likely to affect women, or conditions that are more likely to occur in women, there's less research in them. So one of the, this actually isn't, well, I do talk about endometriosis in the book, but I looked into it more for a recent podcast episode I just did. And one of the things that I found quite sad about endometriosis research is it's very underfunded, that's the case for all sorts of conditions that affect women. But recently, endometriosis researchers have come up with this trump card that they think is going to get them a lot more funding. And it's that endometriosis isn't a reproductive condition, it's an inflammatory condition. And suddenly, it's not about the women's reproductive system, it's about the inflammatory system, which can affect anyone, and therefore that makes it important, which I just find really depressing. Like, it's good for endometriosis, and also, obviously, it's important to know, you know, that we now understand the disease a bit better, that it is actually the whole body is involved, it's not just related to the womb, even though, of course, it is about womb tissue growing outside of the womb, but it involves the inflammatory system, which is kind of depressing.
It's really depressing, and here we are really into power relations. You also just have some examples on how much of funding in the female disease doesn't get funded, even for example if you're giving birth and you could occur that you the contra
Contractions.
Thank you. Stop up, and then you had this interview with a professor studying this, and showing it would be quite easy to develop some medication to improve that, but she didn't get funding.
Yeah, that was staggering, really. I actually need to follow up with her to find out where she's got to. So, basically, we don't really know a lot about. When women are not going to be able to give birth vaginally. It's hard to predict it. It wouldn't be hard if we researched it, but we haven't researched it, so that's why it's hard to predict it. We can't tell beforehand which women are going to need an emergency cesarean. And this woman started looking into this. And so basically, not only can we not predict it, we only have one drug that we can give, and it works on half of women. So half of women that take this drug go on to give birth vaginally when they've been having trouble having their contractions. And she wanted to look into why. Imagine, novel idea, wanting to understand why a drug only works for half of the people you give it to. And she found that the people who it didn't work on had higher acid in their blood. And so what she did was she created this trial where she gave 50% of them just an antacid, like a really cheap antacid, and the others just got the oxycontin, which is the oxycotin, not oxycontin. Oxycontin's the bad one. and it had this huge effect. 80% of the women who were given the antacid before being given the oxycotin went on to give birth vaginally. And, you know, as she said, you know, this wasn't like a very carefully designed trial. She didn't like sort of individualize the dose compared with weight, and she didn't sort of figure out the exact right time to give it. So the end result could be even more positive. Mm-hmm. And she wanted funding to be able to explore this further. And the thing that's really frustrating is she went for specifically this funding that is for research that will help people in lower and middle income countries where the death rate in the maternal mortality rate is much, much higher. And a lot of it is as a result of unsafe cesarean sections. So this could have a massive impact. I mean, the maternal mortality rate in countries where some kind of cheap intervention like antacid would make a huge impact. But yeah, she was refused funding on the basis that basically this isn't important enough. Mm. Saving women's lives in childbirth, just not important enough.
Unbelievable. Mm. Mm. And you wrote that even when there's research done on female diseases, and sometimes you do animal studies in medical research, they would use male animals.
Yeah.
And male cells.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You really see that this is baked in this bias into all of the research. In your chapter on public life, you talk about the gross domestic product and economics and how much of this invisible work, reproductive work and the care work and everything that often women do is not represented in the statistics. And then before we got here, you told me that Norway actually was the good exception.
Yeah.
But then what happened?
Yeah, so Norway used to be really feminist and then everyone else dragged you down to our level. So Norway used to actually include unpaid care work in your accounting, your national accounts. But then in order to be able to make Norway's accounts comparable internationally, you had to stop doing it and move to GDP. So, you know, that's a sad story. But I think Norway can still be proud. You know, you were doing very well. And I'm sorry for what we did to you.
And you even are in aspects of life where you really wouldn't expect that there is could be a gendered perspective to it. For example, you talk about snow shoveling in Sweden and how where the municipality removes snow on the street also has consequences for women.
Yeah. Mm. So snow clearing is sexist. You heard it here first. So basically, it started with this town in Sweden. I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly. Called Karlskoga. Karlskoga?
Yeah.
Does that sound okay? Mm. Anyway, okay, you guys don't care. it's a town in Sweden called Karlskoga, and they were doing a gender audit of all their local government policies, which, let me tell you, from the UK, sounds completely amazing. We would never do that. And one of the things that they looked into was the snow clearing schedule. And they realized that they were clearing snow in such a way that benefited men over women. And the reason for that is that average male and female travel patterns tend to be different. So on average, men are more likely to drive and they're more likely to have a fairly simple travel pattern to and from work. And women are more likely to use public transport. So they're more likely to be walking. And they're also more likely to do a type of travel called trip chaining. And that is because of their combination of paid and unpaid work. So things like dropping the children off at school before they go into work, maybe picking up groceries on the way home, dropping in on an elderly relative. They're tying all this together. And so this means that they're doing more circuitous routes, they're using local roads more, and they are walking more. And the way that this municipality had traditionally done the snow clearing was the way it's done in most municipalities around the world, which is you clear the major thoroughfares first, and then you clear the local roads and pavements. And so they thought, well, let's see what happens if we turn it on its head and clear the pavements and local roads first, and then clear the major roads. And they figured that it was probably harder to push a buggy or walk through 3 inches of snow than it was to drive a car. When they did this, though, they found that not only did it not cost them any more money, it actually saved them money because it brought down their healthcare bill. And the reason for that is that, yeah, it is harder to push a buggy through 3 inches of snow than to drive a car. And way more, in fact, the majority people who were admitted to accident and emergency in hospital during ice conditions were pedestrians, and the majority of those pedestrians were women, and they also suffered the most severe injuries from slipping and falling. And the entire cost of those admissions into hospital in one winter season, in one of the estimates, was three times the cost of a single season's winter road maintenance. Wow. So it was like quite a big saving just from switching up the order in which they cleared the roads. Mm. So snow clearing is sexist, but feminism saves you money. That's the that's the main slogan of the day.
Right. You collected all the evidence. It's become a thick book. What would you like to happen now? What should happen now? Who's supposed to take action?
Everyone. All of you, you know, like, because it's systemic and it's everywhere, right? So people who work in HR, people who work in economics, people who work in science research, people who are doing childcare, like, it's every single person has a role to play and has something that they can do. Whatever your area is, however you work, whether it's paid or unpaid, there is something that you can be doing to address this. Even just as consumers, you know, there are things that you could be doing. Like, if everyone asked when they were purchasing a car, do you have the statistics for how safe this is for women versus men? And they had to say no, and you said, well, then I'm not buying your car. You know, they might have to actually make some changes. So that's what I hope. I hope that enough people read the book that they become as infuriated as I am and as you now are, and you know, can't stop themselves from taking on these challenges.
But you have many examples in the book. Also one, for example, on virtual reality and how there was this incident and that the player, a female player, was sexually harassed when playing, which is something that's happening quite often in online gaming, actually. But then if it's virtual reality, if it's supposed to feel real, it really feels like an abusement. And when those game providers were confronted with it, they really were, our apologies, and changed this by introducing this bubble around your body. But they also said that they didn't even have considered that something like this could happen. And then I wonder if these male technology designers don't even know what they don't know, how would they change something about it?
Well, get more female designers. You know, I mean, I don't think that, like, as you said, these male designers, they were horrified that this had happened in their game, and they were horrified that they hadn't thought of it. But I think it's quite normal they hadn't thought of it, because that's not their daily reality. And if they had had women involved in the design team who were part of the ongoing online gaming community, you can be sure that wouldn't have been overlooked. So it's not that, you know, we somehow need to train men to know exactly what it's like to experience the world as a woman. It's that you need to also, you know, you need to have a diverse team when you're coming up with products and solutions and government policies that affect everyone. You know, you'd have the same problem if you had an all-female team trying to design something that would work for men. It'd be too small. But that's never been the issue. So it's of course men won't always know what it is that they're missing. And that's the basic argument for diversity in all kinds of leadership roles.
So when we talk about change, is what we all of us can do, that we have more diverse teams. Mm-hmm. And then you also talk about that we should collect the data that is missing. So even, for example, when there are very little studies on pregnant women, medical studies, mm-hmm. because you can't include them in research mm-hmm. for various reasons, and this is understandable. But then at least you write, you could document how diseases develop mm-hmm. when a pregnant woman is getting sick. Or you also talk about catastrophes, crises that mm-hmm. occur. And then somebody should at least document and do the statistics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, a really infuriating example of this most recently, of course, was the COVID vaccines, where they hadn't done any research on their interaction in pregnancy. And so pregnant women in the UK, for example, were the most vaccine skeptical, which is not surprising because, for a start, you know, when you're pregnant, you're told, like, you know, don't even look at blue cheese, it'll kill you and your baby, right? So suddenly being told, here's this vaccine and we haven't tested it on pregnant women and you should really discuss it with your doctor. In fact, at first, they weren't allowed to have it. You weren't allowed to have it when you were pregnant. And then they moved to, okay, well, you can have it so long as you discuss it carefully with your doctor. You know, and by the time they finally got to, okay, actually, no, we should prioritize this group for vaccines because actually COVID is incredibly dangerous if you're pregnant. It's like 14 times more dangerous, 14 times more deadly, one study found. You know, it was kind of too late by then because the message had gone out, this hasn't been tested, we don't know the safety. And you're talking to this group of people that is told all the time, you need to be incredibly careful about everything you put into your body, otherwise you'll harm your baby. And that could have been avoided and should have been avoided, you know, because right from the very beginning of the development of the vaccines, there were people saying, you have to make sure that this is tested in pregnancy. They didn't do, for example, the animal toxicity studies until the vaccine was already improved in humans. You know, they should have been doing that right from the very beginning, and they didn't do that. And so they weren't even able to say that we've shown it's not toxic. So yeah, that was frustrating, and women died. You know, young pregnant women died as a result of that.
It's shocking.
You know, and we knew from other coronavirus outbreaks that this was likely to affect pregnant women more. You know, that happened in SARS. It was much more dangerous during pregnancy. So there was really no excuse for not having done the research.
I thought I also could get into sports sciences in the training, but I see that we are approaching 1 hour already. Okay. That was really quick. So I would like to give the audience a chance to ask you questions.
Okay.
Once they first have you here, and somebody help us with the microphone.
Hello, thank you for your speech and that you are lifting up all these teams. I have been a long-term feminist for 60 years. And all these teams has been discussing and we have been fighting to do something with it for many years. Mm. For example, this with women health. It is a professor here in Trondheim called Berit Schei, who is the first professor working with women health. Now she's retired and her position is taken away. Mm. It's not there anymore. So we have to fight all the time to do something with this, with this oppression. My question is, how is it possible that we have been fighting for 100 years, mm-hmm. 200 years, or yeah, for me, 50 years, mm-hmm. and nothing has changed so very much. Mm-hmm. That's the question. And I also have an invitation for you, because in Trondheim, we has a feminist house, the first feminist house in Norway, where we really try to be inspired by Virginia Woolf to say it's important for women to have their own room to find out and have dialogue to make acting about all these mm-hmm. things. Thank you.
You know, I don't think it should surprise us that it takes so long. I mean, we are trying to overturn millennia of structural oppression. It took, so if you look at the fight to get the vote in the UK, right? Women fought their whole lives and died without having won that fight. Millicent Fawcett, who was one of the most famous suffragists in the UK, she, at the age of 19, was collecting signatures for the first petition to be handed into Parliament to demand the right to vote for women. That was in the 1800s, I think, 1860-something. And she was up in the Ladies' Gallery in 1928 when women in the UK were finally granted equal voting rights with men. She died in 1929. That was her whole life on just that one fight. You know, this stuff does take time. And I suppose my, you know, one of my reasons for writing the book is that I feel like one of the things that holds us back is that so much of it is invisible. And so much of it we don't notice that's going on because of thinking that men are our default, and that men are gender neutral, that men are universal. And I do think that that's part of the problem. You know, the number of times, like one of the things that kind of made me write the book was I'd had one too many arguments with annoying men where like I would look at some kind of policy document and say, it doesn't mention women at all. And they would reply, well, it doesn't mention men either. And I knew that you don't have to mention men because men go without saying, we don't mark the male, the men are gender neutral. So that's part of the problem, is we don't mark the male. And to give a more trivial example, when you talk about sport, certainly in the UK, we talk about like football, women's football, rugby, women's rugby, right? The men are the gender neutral one. They're not gender neutral, they're men. but allowing them to occupy that spot means that so much of this is invisible. And when something's invisible, it's really hard to fight it. Because as well as fighting it, first of all, you have to make the case that it even exists. And I think that's what women have to spend a lot of our time doing, making the case that this even is happening, which is exhausting and infuriating and is why some of it takes so long. But, you know, also, you know, the other reason, of course, is sexism. That's why we have to fight so hard and why it takes so long, you know, because women do experience structural oppression. And it's not just that we have to fight so hard to make the change, it's that we have to fight so hard to maintain the change. And changes can be taken away, like you said about this professor, or if you look in America, what's just happened with abortion rights, they've just suddenly had them taken away, and women are dying now. And that's scary. But why does it take, so yeah, that's why I think it takes so long. I think it's partly having to make the case that this problem even exists, because it's invisible. And I think also it's that there is still sexism. And until we get rid of sexism, until we get rid of misogyny, we're going to have to carry on fighting. And I don't expect this fight to be over in my lifetime either. Sorry, it's not a very jolly answer. It wasn't a very jolly question.
Hi, I just listened to your podcast episode about the data that we collect on the internet and how dangerous that can be for us. Mm. And especially now, since you mentioned like US and abortion. In that episode, you talked a lot about the US, but I was thinking more like, how do you think the data that we collect on the internet can be used against us, like in Norway and UK and mm-hmm. the Europe? Like how is the different, mm-hmm. hopefully possibly, but maybe negatively as well?
Mm-hmm. So, it is, we have slightly more protections here because of the laws on GDPR, although actually I don't know if GDPR covers Norway. Does it? It does. Okay. So that makes it much harder for companies to just sell our data. But it doesn't stop police being able to subpoena the data. And so that's really where the concern is. And so in the UK, when we're talking about abortion, right, most people in the UK are not aware that abortion is actually criminalised in the UK. They think it's legalised. It's not legalised. What we have is the 1967 Abortion Act, where if two doctors agree that it would be more dangerous for you to continue your pregnancy than to end it, then you can end it up to 23 weeks and 6 days, I think. So if you have an abortion outside of that, if you purchase an abortion pill on your own, if you have an abortion at 24 weeks, then you can be prosecuted. And women are being prosecuted in the UK, and their data is being subpoenaed by the police, things like Facebook messages, iMessages, period tracking data is being used to prosecute women. So, it's harder for it to be used commercially. But of course, the other thing is that it still is used commercially because the internet is American and most companies are based in America. And so they are using your data. So I've actually that episode really freaked me out. So I've stopped using Google for searching anything that's private to me, because the idea that they're selling my personal medical information to advertise things to me makes me feel sick. And I recommend you all do the same. It's worrying. You know, it's worrying, particularly in the context of a world where abortion rights are under attack, and it's not just in America, it's in lots of other countries. You know, as more countries become more concerned about fertility rates, for example, and we vote in more right-wing governments who are more pro-women staying at home and having babies, then, you know, this stuff's going to become more concerning. So it's incredibly frustrating. And if you're at all worried about anyone getting hold of your period tracking data, I suggest you don't track your period in an app. Because at the moment, there isn't a period tracking app that is properly encrypted where they can't hand over your data. Like, that's ultimately what they need to develop, is one where that company can't even access the data themselves. And if it's encrypted in that way, then it doesn't matter. The police can subpoena them. They can't hand it over. At the moment, that doesn't exist.
Hi. So I was one of the people who read your book and just went on like this rant to all my friends. And I noticed that of all my friends who actually picked the book up and read it, are all female. And I had so many questions, and I had so many debates with my male friends as well, and a lot of them have been shocked, but not a single one of them have actually picked up the book and read it themselves. So for me, it's been like, how do I get people to read the book, those who should read the book, and actually understand this bias? Mm-hmm. Because they're not reading it, so I'm still kind of frustrated about that.
Mm. I feel like that's a question for my publisher. I think you're doing what you can. You know, you're spreading the message, and you can't. I mean, much as I would like to force everyone to buy and read the book, I probably can't do that. Like, my own brother hasn't read the book. He says he read the extract in The Guardian, and that's enough. That gave him enough of an idea. I think that the best that we can do is carry on talking about it and using what we know from the information that we've read, the research that we've done, the books that we've read, to pass on that knowledge to people who realistically aren't going to read the book. The other option, of course, is that I turn it into a novel. And maybe that will con the men into reading it. I tried to con men into reading it by putting data in the title. And that's worked somewhat. Definitely men have been reading it though, which has been really great. And that was my aim in writing the book. You know, I didn't want this to be a book that was just preaching to the choir. I didn't want it to be a book that was only read by women, and specifically women who already agree with me, you know, because I really believe in changing people's minds, because it happened to me by a book. So I know that it can happen. I know that you can go from someone who doesn't get feminism at all and really intensely dislikes feminism to someone who's sitting here on a stage now banging on about feminism for an hour and a half. So I tried very hard to write the book in such a way that it was accessible to people who might even go in feeling a bit defensive when they when they started it. So maybe tell your friends that she wrote it for you, and then they'll feel guilty, and then they'll read it, and then they'll be like, oh yeah, I get it. Actually, do you know what? That did genuinely happen. Not the guilty thing, but this woman I met told me her husband apologized to her after reading the book, because she said they'd been having arguments about the sharing of the unpaid work, the childcare and stuff, and he'd always insisted that it was pretty equal. And she was like, no, it really isn't. And then he read the book and was like, oh, okay, yeah, fair enough. That describes me, sorry. So it can happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Caroline, for making a really well-researched book. I like cite it all the time, and I love how many examples you come with. I was thinking a bit about this with intersectionality within feminism that we're currently talking a lot about, and you have some examples as well where of studies of women who also have minority backgrounds, and I was wondering if you could say a bit about that or mention some of those studies. Thank you.
So that was one of the really frustrating things about writing the book, actually, is that I wanted to be able to say much more about that than I was able to. And the reason I wasn't able to is because the research isn't disaggregated. So generally, if you get research, if you get data disaggregated, if you're lucky, it will be disaggregated into sex, and then you'll have one chunk of, and this is ethnicity, which obviously mixes men and women together and makes it much, much harder to be able to talk about the specific experience, let's say, of black women. So I remember I wanted to find out how many black female academics who were professors there were in the UK when I was writing the book, and that data I couldn't get that data because they had female professors and they had black professors, but they didn't have black female professors. I did actually end up finding out that I think it was something like 3 or something, and that there were way more black male professors. And that to me seems like an important disparity that we should be talking about, that, you know, we talk about ethnic minorities achieving success in academia, but we're hiding the fact that it's actually a lot worse for the women. And therefore, any kind of intervention that you're going to do surely should be addressing that. But if you don't present the data in such a way that we actually start talking about it, then you're never going to be able to fix it. So yeah, that was a big frustration when I was writing the book. One of the things that I did get to write about, though, briefly, was maternal mortality rates. And in the US, this is the case in the UK as well, maternal mortality rates are much higher in America for African American women. I think it's 243% higher. And actually, the US has the worst maternal mortality rate in the developed world. And it's going up, where in every other country it's coming down. Of course, now with Dobbs, it's going to go up even more. Because of, you know, of the obvious reasons, like, for example, if you have an ectopic pregnancy or a septic pregnancy and you're not going to be able to get an abortion because of abortion laws, and so women are going to die. So this is actually worse for African American women. And the thing that was interesting, and this is another example of why it's really good to be able to disaggregate the data, they found that African American women who went to college had higher maternal mortality rates than white women who didn't go to college. So showing that really wasn't, you couldn't put that down to class or to income. That was really isolated down to race. that's a really important thing to know if you want to try and fix it, because that gives you an idea of what the problem is, which is obviously racism. But if you haven't, if you didn't have that data disaggregated, you wouldn't be able to make that intervention so so directly.
Hi. You were talking earlier about COVID and the COVID studies. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing a lot of women and girls talking about their menstrual cycle changing and bleeding changing. Mm-hmm. And it really upset me that it wasn't taken seriously, mm-hmm. at least not at first. It upset me because I was thinking, if a guy's sperm came out green, that would not be happening. Like, that would be an immediate stop. And so, but then women, you know, started speaking up and the media wrote about it, but still the answer sort of was, well, the menstruational cycle is a complicated thing. And, you know, you guys just, it changes all the time. And you know, yeah. So how do we like fight that problem, you know, that we're not taken seriously and that we're like talked to as if we don't know what's happening with our own bodies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was furious about that, actually. So the first issue, of course, is that they didn't bother looking into the menstrual cycle when they were testing the vaccine. So, you know, if they had, they might have been able to warn women from the outset, look, this is what might happen to your menstrual cycle. It would have made a lot of women feel a lot less nervous. They also would have been able to say, for example, you know, if you don't want your menstrual cycle to be impacted, maybe have the vaccine at this point in your cycle rather than this point. And instead, what we had was women starting to say, you know, I'm noticing this change, and the medical profession saying, there, dear, you don't have any idea what you're talking about. And that's just really dangerous, actually, because menstruation is actually a really important indicator for health. And by muddying the issue, that meant that there were probably women who... well, in fact, I know that there were women who thought that the change in their menstrual cycle may have been down to the vaccine because they didn't know how long the impact should last. And it actually transpired that the change to their menstrual cycle was something much more serious. And they didn't go to the doctor about it because no one had quantified it and said, this is exactly what you should be looking out for. This is why we need to know what side effects there are. You know, side effects are important. And just saying to women, never mind, it's probably temporary and like it may be this long, it may be that long. It just is taking women's health incredibly unseriously. I was completely furious about it. How we change it is, I think, that we collect the data. You know, we do the research so that we can be very specific about what the impact is going to be, very specific about what the side effects can be, and so that women know these are the parameters within which I should be affected. If I'm outside of those parameters, okay, it's not the vaccine, this is something more serious, I should go to my doctor. By creating this very muddy, confusing scenario, it meant that some women who should have gone to the doctor didn't, and probably some women who were fine panicked because they had no idea what was going on. My period was really delayed. I thought I was pregnant. You know, like, this kind of stuff matters for women. We do keep an eye on our menstrual cycle. We know when it's late. We know very well. And to be patronized and told that you probably just, like, made a mistake is infuriating. Yeah, I don't have a very good answer for you, but just I was really fucking pissed off as well. So.
Thank you.
Thank you for a very inspiring and probably infuriating topic and talk. And not to brag, I have read the book, and I'm happy to. And I thought it was an excellent question on how to get not only men, but also those females that are so extremely non-feminists to read it. It's important. But I wonder if you have some advice for us those few of us men that do read it or are focused on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Advice for men. where do I start? talk to other men. You know, that's the advice for men. Men can speak to men in a way that men don't listen to women in the way that they listen to men. You know, that really is the job of men in this movement, is to speak to other men and bring them on board. Because not only is it, it's not just that men don't necessarily listen to women when we say it, it's also that you know what it's like to be a man in this world. I don't. So I can't speak to a man in the same way that you can and emote with him and empathize with him the things that he's gone through, because they haven't happened to me. You know, I can do that with women. One of the things that's really nice for women talking to other women about feminism or sexism is you don't have to explain anything because they've been through it too. You sort of say, oh, this guy said whatever to me. If you tell a guy that, they're like, oh, well, maybe he meant this and maybe he meant that. And, you know, are you sure you aren't overreacting? And the women are just like, oh, what a wanker. and I expect it's the same for men, right? Like, there are experiences that you have that are so common, you don't even need to explain it. So I think that that's really the male superpower when it comes to feminism is talking to other men, knowing how to speak to other men. So that's your job.
We've run out of time, so okay. We have no time for more questions, sadly.
Oh, that's a pity. Thank you so much, Caroline. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your book.
Thank you.